Session number 13170.
Yeah, that's right.
Professor Hanbury Brown, Reel 3. Mm. I just asked you about the question about the personality clash between Roe and Bowen.
A long story, really. The point was that Bowen was one of Watson Watt's original people. Watson Watt and Wilkins. I beg your pardon, Bowen and Wilkins were his two main sort of assistants who developed radar originally. And then we went to Bordsey Manor, and they were both senior. Wilkins was in charge of all the work on CH, and Bowen was in charge of airborne radar. And then Watson Watt left Bordsey Manor to be DCD in London. He went up, and it was important that he should go up because, in fact, it was necessary to persuade the Air Ministry to use radar and develop it. But Roe succeeded him, and Roe did not, so to speak, promote or get on very well with Watson Watt's original senior protégés. In fact, he imported W.B. Lewis from Cambridge, the Cavendish Laboratory, and put him in charge of research. And, of course, Wilkins did not get the senior position, and Roe never really got on very well with Bowen. Bowen, they, in a sense, of course, they never forgave Roe for not being Watson Watt. Roe was a sort of rather bureaucratic, fussy little man. They didn't actually like him. And I think, you know, that's what it was, really. It was a long story of dislike. And then it was exacerbated by the division of the airborne system, airborne group being in St. Athan, and the main body of the station being in Dundee. And, of course, it was all exacerbated by the fact that the move to Dundee was very, very badly handled, and Bowen resented that very much, and so on and so forth. But the question of the minimum range was a point, a sort of storm in a teacup. It was a sort of last straw. Bowen felt that we had all the experience of flying, that we knew what the Royal Air Force was doing with AI, and to be told by Roe and Lewis in Dundee that the main difficulty with AI was that the minimum range was not adequately short. We felt, you know, it was teaching a grandmother to suck eggs, that they didn't know they hadn't flown like we'd flown, and that we knew better than they did. And this wasn't the main problem. The main problem with AI was actually A, reliability, training, maintenance, and above all, the absence of GCI, and we knew this. Anyhow, it turned out rather well, because Lewis, in fact, placed a contract with EMI to tackle this problem of getting the minimum range down. And by good fortune, or whatever it is, the man who was in charge of the work at EMI was a man who was perhaps, I wouldn't be surprised, the greatest electronic engineer of his generation, the most able man that I've ever met, anyhow, in applied science. His name was Blumlein, A.D. Blumlein. And he produced a solution to the partial solution. Well, it turned out to be a complete solution to the problem of minimum range of AI Mark III. He produced an entirely new modulator called the Blumlein modulator, which was extremely ingenious. It involved charging up a delay line and then discharging this through the transmitter, and then a delayed pulse into the transmitter, which damped the circuits down at the end of the pulse and produced a sharp tail. And this worked beautifully and was adopted for AI Mark IV. AI Mark IV was produced in the course of 1940. The engineering was done at the Royal Aircraft Establishment under the direction, I imagine, of A.G. Touch, who went there from us in order to engineer ASV. And this gave a beautiful you could see another airplane just separate at 500 feet. I tested it at Christchurch sometime in 1940, and it worked beautifully. And that was one feature of AI Mark IV. The other feature was the one I've already spoken about. We changed the vertical polarization. And when these two things were done, we had a system which did everything which we'd originally planned the AI set would do when we first thought about it years before. And that set, coupled with GCI, which came in 1941, produced an effective system. In point of fact, the first AI-GCI combat took place in November 1940. I think Cunningham shot down aircraft in November 1940. I can't remember. That was the first AI-GCI, well, the first GCI set. But then, once it had been shown how to do it by people like Cunningham and so on, a highly intelligent person, de Havilland's test pilot, then rapidly, it came into action. And by about May 1941, in the early part of 1941, night raids, the AI-equipped night fighter became the principal weapon for defense at night. And the number of kills produced by GCI and AI greatly exceeded the number of kills that were produced by the AA guns. I mean, if you look at the statistics on the number of kills produced by AA guns, it's not all that good. But I'm not too sure about this, but I think in May 1941, in May alone, we got down 100 AI-GCI kills, confirmed kills. And, you know, it worked very well. And that, of course, is really, it was a good thing that it did work then. But it could have worked before. If GCI had been available for the night raids in the autumn of 1940, earlier on, AI Mark IV would have been far more effective. AI Mark III and II, one never had a chance, because not only was unreliable equipment and so on, but I mean it wasn't that bad, but there was no system for guiding the fighter aircraft. It was as simple as that. That's the story of AI. Meter wave AI.
Did you personally work with Cat's Eye Cunningham?
Yes, but I did, yes. I did on another project. I worked with FIU mainly, with Chamberlain. And those people, I've met Cunningham, I think. I can't remember, but yes, I have met Cunningham. Of course I have. No, my meeting with Cunningham was a rather unfortunate one, really. Well, when you say work with Cunningham, we were sent for by Lord Charwell at one point. And I can't remember exactly what date. But my heart sank when I heard this. I thought, oh Lord, I know what this is. And sure enough, we were sat down in a room in the Air Ministry, and Charwell came in, and he said, or in the cabinet office or somewhere, and he came in and said, I want the system of long aerial mines to be tested. I want you to test it. And this was Cunningham that had been sent for, and me. And we sat there dismally, and he explained how the system of long aerial mines was supposed to work. As a matter of fact, I knew quite a lot about it before I went. But the idea, of course, was that you had in your mind, you saw this enemy force coming in at night in the dark, and you dropped a curtain of mines hanging from parachutes and wires in front of this force, which then ran into it, like a sort of protective curtain. And so your fighter went along the top, dropping these damn mines, producing this curtain. And I knew that a bit about it. I knew, for example, that the lethality of the mines was not that good, actually. But quite apart from the lethality being low, the point which I made to Charwell was that the fighter you didn't know where the enemy was at that time. There was no GCI then. You didn't know where the enemy was. You might know where the fighter was to a certain degree of approximation by the DF system, but you didn't know where the enemy was. Dropping these mines is not going to be a very effective method of defense. And he wouldn't have anything of it. He said, no, I want the system tested. So we went to Middle Wallop. I can't remember what sort of aeroplane, but it had this awful thing in it for dropping things out and cutting wires and parachutes and, you know, these mine things. And I found that frightfully dangerous. And I flew with Cunningham. Cunningham's a very good pilot. He's very steady and calm and a marvelous chap. We flew around and dark, some enormous height, like 20,000 feet, freezing cold, dropping these things out. But after I'd done, I think, two or three nights of this, I thought to myself, I don't know what I'm doing here. I mean, I'm not, you know, the radar's got nothing to do with it. And they don't know where the enemy is. They don't know where they are themselves most of the time, anyhow. So I thought, I went back to TRE, and I said to the superintendent, to AP Rowe, I don't want to do this. It's useless. And it so happened that AP Rowe, who didn't like Charwell at all, had heard about this aerial mine system, which was a classic thing. It had been floating about for a long time, you know, this aerial mine. People had been trying to avoid doing it. And he agreed with me. He sent me back to FIU, and I went on doing what I was doing before. So I got out of it. That's all I did with Cunningham.
You said earlier that about the very good work that the fighter interception unit did.
Yes.
Can you say a bit more about them and why?
Oh, yes, they did a very good job. Chamberlain was an extremely active person, and they had, it was a very good interaction between the technical people, the scientists, research scientists, and the RAF. A very good interaction. And when you read about Germany and all these other things and places, you know, you tend to suspect that there was not that good liaison between the research and development and the operational people. Because when you're developing a thing like AI, for example, you need very close contact between the user and the man who's trying to design it. And FIU was one of those places where there was a very good interaction between people and new things. And it's no good sending this stuff to an operational squadron. They don't know how to test things. But Chamberlain did know, and he was very systematic and thorough. And he also used to put up airplanes into... He used to put up one or two of his airplanes more into the actual... defense system at night. He used to get the position in the sort of cab rank of fighters. He used to put up some of his own fighters, which would have a go. And that kept them, so to speak, au fait with the actual operational. They were actually in contact with the operational side at the same time as they were in contact with the scientists. And this is a fairly rare thing in the development of military equipment. To have such close collaboration. It's very good. I'd like to talk about AI Mark V, because that's something which I put so much of myself into. And it's never. Okay?
Please.
Yeah. Is it on?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, well, to illustrate sort of the efficacy of FIU. I was always very interested in the problem of interception, the actual dynamics of interception, because, for example, in the war we got many reports that AI Mark IV, following an enemy aircraft under GCI, that the enemy aircraft was taking evasive action. We had a lot of this problem, and so they lost it, because it was taking evasive action. And I often doubted if this was true. Well, if you work out these problems, and you try it. I did some experimental flying, actually. If you're too close to... If a fighter approaches the bomber, if it gets too close, then any correction it makes to its course to follow the bomber develops into an unstable oscillation in its track. You can show this very easily. You can show it mathematically on a computer very easily, but the easiest thing to do is to do it in the air. And I have actually done it in the air, because you make a small correction if you're too close. The two aeroplanes then proceed to separate very far, and then there's a delay in making the next correction. And so the thing builds up into an uncontrollable weave behind the bomber. And that, I think, is the explanation of most of the invader's action. The remedy of it, the remedy for this is to get yourself into position, say, 6,000 feet or a mile or so behind the bomber once you've got it, get onto its course, set your gyro for its course, and then once you've got it in the center, up and down, left and right, you've got it in the right position to go in on that gyro course, and to, watching the echo getting closer, and use your operator simply to tell you where the enemy aeroplane is relative to you, but not make corrections to your course. Now, if you do that, your chances of actually intercepting are greatly increased. Now, if that was discussed with FIU, for example, and FIU then did a whole series of things, and they then published a thing, you know, advising people how to do it. That was just one of the things they did. The main thing they did, though, was to test new systems. Now, what I was interested in was if you got rid of the operator in AI Mark V, you've got rid of a good deal of the operator's work in AI Mark IV, in which you had an operator just telling the pilot what to do. I thought that if the pilot could have seen on his dashboard just a spot showing him where the aeroplane was relative to his field of view, that it would be able, we would be able to cut down some of this trouble of losing aeroplanes when close to them and improve interception. And so I developed a thing called AI Mark IVA, in which you put manually, the operator put a strobe manually onto the enemy aircraft, the target echo, and then that drove a spot indicator on the pilot's dashboard. And this thing grew wings as the range decreased. It got bigger, but it moved about on his spot indicator. He had a cathode ray tube on his dashboard, and it moved about, showing its relative angle to the fighter aircraft. And that was Mark IVA, and we took it to FIU, and they flew around with it and said, this is fine, we want certain modifications. We made the modifications, and eventually that came out as AI Mark V. Well, due to the progress of things, this didn't materialize until too late in the war to be very effective. Mosquitoes were fitted with AI Mark V, I think, and certain other aeroplanes. And I believe that it was really quite effective. But what I'm really saying is that the research that we would have done on AI at Martlesham Heath in 1939, if we'd had the time, was never done until very much later. And the reason why was that we had to produce Mark I, Mark II AI and the early AIs. That stopped all the research work. Whereas this business of presenting the relative position of the aeroplane to the pilot is something that we'd always wanted to try. It was eventually tried, produced AI Mark V with the approval of FIU, who tested it thoroughly. But I don't think it had enough time in the war to be effective, because by that time, meter wave radar was replaced by centimeter waves.
During this whole period, how much pressure did you feel yourself to be under because of the necessity of meeting the challenge of the Luftwaffe? How much political pressure was there?
Oh, yes, everything was done absolutely, desperately, urgently, yes. Yes, always, always under pressure, yes. Oh, yes, indeed. It was never relaxed. Of course, I've talked entirely about AI. I haven't talked about ASV at all. ASV had a different history. I took the first ASV sets to, after I'd been at Northolt and introduced AI Mark I to 25 Squadron, and had made the point about the need for GCI, I went back and rejoined the group and worked on ASV, because that had been rather neglected. I took the first ASV, fitted in a Hudson aircraft, to a squadron at Lucas in early 19... Well, I can't remember. I think early 19... Late in 1939 or early, yes, January 1940, I should think. And that was a simple forward-looking thing. ASV Mark I was a very unreliable set. We had to go up to an operation. I had to go up to an operational squadron doing a reconnaissance of the North Sea. It was very... very unwelcome to have a complicated piece of equipment arriving in an operational squadron with absolutely no provision for maintenance or anybody to look after it or any spare parts or anything, you know, additional staff or anything like that. And when I first arrived in Lucas, I went into the signals officer's office, who was in charge of the signal station, and said, I have brought you the first Hudsons fitted with ASV radar for reconnaissance, which will detect ships from the air. This is a new branch of air reconnaissance, a new departure, so to speak. Very important. And he said, that may well be. But if you look at the paperwork on my desk, which is stacked about 2 feet high, he said, my job is to send in these reports to Coastal Command on flights of pigeons. Each one of these forms represents a pigeon flight. We're testing the use of carrier pigeons released from the aircraft for rescue purposes or something. And I have to do these tests on. So if you don't mind, would you go down to the aerodrome and show your radar to the flight sergeant? And so I went out of the door. He said, and there's another thing. He said, these boxes keep on arriving here, marked secret, and we're running out of cupboards in which to put them. They have to be locked up because these things are secret. And he said, we haven't got any more cupboards. And there was a whole row of cupboards. And I said, well, let me see what's inside them. And we opened these cupboards, and there were IFF sets. And they'd locked them up in the cupboards because he didn't know what they were for, but that they were secret. Well, as you realize, of course, IFF was designed in order to identify our own aircraft crossing the coast, the CH station, so we'd know the difference between them and enemy aircraft. I'm just illustrating what happens when you introduce new devices into a military force which is busy and doesn't want to have to deal with new things. Now, in fact, we put ASV Mark I in these aeroplanes. Their job was to fly from Lucas across to the Norwegian coast. Now, you watch a cathode ray tube for 2 or 3 hours, and you see nothing on it. Imagine there's no extra member of the crew put on the aeroplane to do this, imagine the boredom of doing that. I mean, no wonder the chaps simply didn't use the things. The only reason ASV Mark I was eventually used in those early days was that we eventually installed a homing beacon, a transponder beacon, on which the aeroplane could home and see this great echo sticking up from the transponder beacon coded thing telling them that that was their station, and they could home on it, and they got the range and bearing from it, and they could home on it. Now, once that was introduced, people were interested in the ASV Mark I being serviceable, and they learned to use it. And it's a rather nice point, actually. It did something for them that they actually wanted. And, of course, the transponder, that's how the first transponder beacons came to be used, actually. And ASV, anyhow, that was ASV. It was substantial. It didn't do any good, really. I mean, it was. Then later on, when it got developed, and Coastal Command appointed proper signals officers and maintenance and all that stuff, and they really got the thing going. Then, of course, it was used for convoy rendezvous and all sorts of things like that. But its range on a submarine, for example, of ASV Mark I in the Hudson and simple dipole installations was very little. Taffy Bowen and I did the first experiments from St. Athan. We got a message from Admiral Somerville saying, would it be possible to detect a submarine by radar? This was in the autumn of 1939, late in 1939, and November 1939, or more, I think. And so we said, well, we'll have a look. You'll give us a submarine and we'll try. So the Admiralty said, all right, you can have L-27 and she'll steam up and down the Solent, and you can base your aeroplane on Gosport. So we took off with the weather was absolutely awful, of course. We took off with the old Hudson, landed it in Gosport after a good deal of trouble, and arranged all these signals with the L-27, how she was to come up on the surface and signal her. As we went over, we were to give her the right signals to show we weren't an enemy aircraft going to bomb her, and then she would steam in a certain direction for a certain time, and then steam in another direction. We had it all printed out, and we got there, and the L-27 came up. It was a fairly filthy day, and we sent all the signals with our Morse code, and then she submerged. And so that wasn't any good, and so we waited a bit. She came up again, and we sent the signals again, and she submerged again. And this time we fired a very light, because we had some very lights and there was some arrangement about very lights. And anyhow, and then she went on her course and we did the experiments. What we didn't know was that the signal lamp on the Hudson aircraft, there's a signal lamp on the top and the signal lamp on the bottom of the Hudson aircraft, and we had the thing switched to the top, and we didn't know because none of us had been in the Hudson aeroplane before, including the pilot. So, of course, the submarine couldn't see our signals because they were all pointing upwards. However, that was the first time that an aeroplane detected a submarine. This is November 1939. We did the original experiments. We got a range of 3.5 miles on the first day. Maximum range head-on, submarine, what you call trim